The leaves turn in the fall. They drop like bitter tears. The hours turn into days, and days become old years. I don't know where to turn.
When I first heard that voice, it really grabbed me. It grabbed my heart. There is a quality to that voice that's intimate without trying to be seductive at all. You sense intelligence, and it's unpretentious. It's warm and a bit melancholy. The great jazz trumpeter Miles Davis said she was his favorite singer. Frank Sinatra was a big fan. It's the voice of Jerry Southern. Not widely known, not widely heard, especially these days. Her career was focused from the early 50s to the early 60s, about a 10-year period, when she recorded for Decca and Capitol and some of the big labels. She performed in nightclubs and on television, had a few cameos in films. You're going to get to know Jerry Southern in this Spinning on Air podcast. I'm David Garland. I've been using Spinning on Air as a platform for exposing listeners to wonderful creative people for over 30 years now. I think that when we hear how creative people think about their work, we can understand it and them better and maybe be inspired ourselves. My father worked in advertising, but every day he came home from work in Boston, he'd sit down at the piano and play and sing popular songs, songs from his youth in the first half of the 20th century, and some of the current songs as well. So I was probably more familiar with that world of music than most people my age. But I had never heard Jerry Southern until about 1990 or so, when I stumbled on one of her recordings in a collection of great pop and jazz vocalists. And her recording, an old Rodgers and Hart number, really stood out for me.
He dances overhead on the ceiling near my bed, in my sight through the night.
I just loved the texture of her voice and her delivery. And in the midst of recordings by Bing Crosby and Sarah Vaughan and others, Jerry Southern sounded very, very new and very contemporary to me. So that sent me on a quest to hear more Jerry Southern. I was able to find a few albums here and there, played them on the radio, and some listener, I'm sorry I don't remember who, put me in touch with Jerry. He gave me her number. I contacted her. And she hadn't done an interview in decades, but she agreed to let me speak with her on the air. You're going to hear that interview in this podcast. As it turned out, it was Jerry Southern's last interview. She died, I think, less than a year later, rather abruptly. She was in her mid-60s. Later, I got to know Jerry's daughter, Catherine King. Catherine's life has been very involved in music. She's been a producer, a recording engineer. She's been doing music publicity for a lot of wonderful artists. And every once in a while in New York, Catherine and I would get together for lunch. Then she moved to the West Coast. And a few years later, I moved to upstate New York. I contacted Catherine, letting her know that I was going to feature her mother's interview in a new podcast. And it turned out that Catherine had moved back to the East Coast and lives only half an hour away from me now. So she was able to join me to speak about her mother, too. And as it happens, Catherine is just about the same age that Jerry was when I interviewed her back in 1990. You'll hear Jerry Southern from her own perspective, and you'll hear about her from Catherine's perspective as well, mother and daughter's comments kind of interwoven. Since podcasts are a downloadable medium, there are rights issues with including Jerry Southern's full recordings from her classic catalog. You will hear just a few excerpts to give you a sense of the texture and sound of her singing. but I've made a Spotify playlist that you can access at spinningonair.org so that you can listen to about an hour's worth of her recordings and hear for yourself the special qualities they have. Some recordings from the 1950s somehow haven't aged as well as Jerry Southern's have. There's something that still feels real and immediate in her performances. I do have a very special discovery to share with you in this podcast, a recording that Jerry Southern made in the last years of her life, a recording of the type of music that Jerry loved to make, but which the public never had a chance to hear. Jerry Southern just improvising at the piano, at home. Jerry was primarily a pianist, and you'll hear her tell how she eventually got into singing, too. But this piano improvisation, which you'll hear later, and excerpts are sprinkled here and there throughout the interview as well, conveys her musicality in a way that's really wonderful to hear. And for me, it conjures up a scene vividly. Jerry Southern, who for a little while there was kind of a star, and that period was decades ago. She's at home in her little apartment in Hollywood, California, playing music just for the joy of doing so. You'll hear her tell how she was so relieved to leave her little bit of stardom behind and move out of the public spotlight into a life that surely suited her sensitive personality better than any Hollywood set or nightclub stage. I never did get to meet Jerry Southern in person. For our interview, she was recorded at KCRW in Santa Monica, and my voice was recorded in New York City at WNYC. A few months after our interview, I did have reason to go to Los Angeles, and I let her know I'd be coming, hoping that we could get together. I called her when I was there, and she said, "Oh, I'm just not feeling quite up to it." She joked that she was sitting up and taking tea, but she wasn't up for more than that. I returned to New York a couple days later and learned that she had died. Even though I never got to meet Jerry in person, my conversation with her was unforgettable, and I loved to listen to her recordings. You'll hear her voice soon. Just the other day, I asked Catherine King if she enjoys listening to her mother's recordings.
Well, when I was a kid, they made me very, very sad. And whenever she would put on her records, I would ask her to take them off.
Really?
Yes. I don't know what it was that that triggered that for me, but I think that the quality that people talk about in her singing, a vulnerability, a softness, it must have just gone to my core. I don't know. And so even though I recognized that she was a wonderful singer and there were people around all the time talking about what a wonderful singer she was, it made me sad to listen to the records. And so eventually she stopped playing her records. I mean, it's not like she sat around and wanted to listen to her own records all the time, but every once in a while, either somebody would be over to our house or It might have been right after she'd done a recording session and she had to listen. It was sweet that she wasn't offended by that. Somehow she understood it.
It made you sad to hear the sadness that you perceived in her voice.
I think that must have been what it is.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing that happened later was I majored in music at UCLA, and my work study job was as a recording engineer in the Institute of Ethnomusicology's recording lab. So by that time, I'm about 19 or 20 years old, and I said to her, "Do you have copies of your recordings?" Because many of them by that time had been deleted from the catalogs. And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, let me make copies of them." So I made her, you know, just 7.5 IPS copies onto reel-to-reel tape. And I did this in a couple of marathon sessions overnight, not during work hours. By that time, I hadn't heard the recordings in a really long time, in many, many years. And I was really enthusiastic about Jimi Hendrix and, you know, Stravinsky, and I was just in another orbit altogether musically. And I was a little apprehensive about, you know, what if I don't like these recordings? And I was really bowled away by them because by that time, I knew more about music just technically, and I they really blew me away, I have to say. It was a shock and a kind of delicious revelation to me.
The way it happened was really very happenstance, you might say, because I was playing, and an agent in Chicago had heard about me, and he offered me a job in Chicago. And he told me that if I could sing a few songs, that he could get me about $10 a week more. At that time, I think I was getting $90 a week. So I thought, 100, you know, that sounded pretty good. So I learned a few songs, like Stormy Weather, Embraceable You, and Can't Help Loving That Man. And I think there was one more. And then I went out on a Navy recruiting tour and sang those songs. And I just kind of learned as I did it. I wanted the whole range to be consistent, and I learned, you know, how to use the mic well so that everything came through, even though it might have been very soft. When I was in high school, my natural voice was soprano. In fact, it was lyric soprano, very, very close to coloratura. And I was taught by the nuns, and they were real nice people, but this particular one didn't know a whole lot about what to do with a teenager's voice, and she had me doing all kinds of operatic arias and coloratura stuff up to like a high E, and it ruined my voice. It just, when I got out of high school, I couldn't even sing a middle C without it splitting into a million pieces. So about a year later, I started studying with a good teacher in Omaha who had studied with one of the great masters in Italy, and he helped me to fix my voice up, and it got to be very, even a better sound than it was before. It was a better voice. Then when I started singing pop stuff, I had to do the whole thing over because I couldn't use my soprano voice to sing The Man I Love. You know, I guess I could have, but nobody would have cared. So I kind of developed this singing voice out of my speaking voice, and I just worked like mad, you know, for tone placement and the right timbre and the right vibrato and all of that. I did that myself, and I was really singing incorrectly after that because I was singing before from the diaphragm and getting it into the mask and all of that stuff, and I couldn't utilize those things when I started to sing pop or jazz or whatever they called it. They called it both. But my voice was sort of, it started out in that kind of light sound.
So you actually made the choice to evolve a new voice out of the speaking voice?
Yes. So it wasn't really very dependable, and in the beginning it had kind of a light sound, and then as it got close to the Cole Porter album days, it got kind of heavier, and I think probably a little richer. But I never quite knew from one year to the other what was going to happen when I opened my mouth. So it was interesting.
You make it sound like you began singing really just for an extra $10 a week.
And I did.
For no other motivation.
I absolutely did, yeah.
Did you start to really enjoy it?
Well, I enjoyed it for a couple of years, but that was about all.
Why was that? What went wrong?
Everything. No, my daughter was growing up at that time, and I just hated being on the road. I missed her so much. And also, there was very little, almost no intellectual challenge left after. I never really had to rehearse very much. I would get a song, and I always reharmonized things. And and sometimes changed melody notes, if there were some real flaws in the song and I liked the song well enough to do it, I took the liberty of changing what I thought needed changing. Mm-hmm. But that didn't take very long, and then I memorized it quickly and started to sing it, and the phrasing part came very, very naturally to me, and I always tried to combine the words that should be together and just make sense out of the lyric and bring out the climaxes and put in the nuances and all of that. And when the intellectual challenge was over and the brain no longer had to work, then ennui set in very quickly. Because really, you know, when you perform and you have to do the same songs every night, mostly the same songs, you know, I Did You Better Go Now, An Occasional Man, and When I Fall in Love, and all of that stuff every night, and I had to. And so you just stand up there or sit there and think, did I leave the iron on in the hotel room? Or something. And everything is kind of rote, and by that time you've learned, you know, where the emotion goes, and you do that automatically. And so there's nothing to think about. I guess that's, you know, there are always some benefits. I guess that's when I started to read. You know, I had to do something with my brain. Mm-hmm. But I really was very bored with it and stayed in it much too long, really, for my own happiness.
Every time we say goodbye, I die a little. Every time we say goodbye, I wonder why a little.
In the interview, Jerry says that one of the reasons she sort of quit going on the road and singing was to spend more time with you. What was your early childhood like?
Well, she had me when she was 22 years old, oh. Which was the custom at the time. Women had started having their families very young, and her career started taking off shortly thereafter. And so she was touring a lot when I was young, and I eventually went to a boarding school from second through fourth grade, which I loathed. And it was difficult, I will say. It's difficult to have a parent on the road all the time. And I'm sure that she was unhappy being separated from me.
Was your father around that time?
Well, she married four times, and she divorced my father, who I was born in Chicago, and then she married a radio disc jockey, and they moved to California from Chicago. And I hated him, but her third husband I really liked. He was a bass player who had been playing with her on her gigs, and they fell in love and got married.
What was his name?
John Kitzmiller. He was a terrific bass player who doubled on tuba, which is why I have a closet affection for tuba. And he did a lot of studio gigs in Hollywood at that time.
Only last Saturday, or was it yesterday?
So he was touring with her. So there wasn't a father at home, which is why I was in boarding school. If I had had my children starting when I was 22, we'd all be in a loony bin right now. I think, you know, 22 is just too early to have children. And so I was very grateful when she made the decision to stop performing, mainly because it made her so miserable. She wanted to perform because she loved playing, and she understood that people loved to hear her. Mm-hmm. But she had a very, very substantial case of performance anxiety, and so she would just get so nervous before performing, even before recording. Less so, of course, because there wasn't an audience there. But so it would kind of put the whole house in a panic.
The house, you mean at the
where
home
I
life?
Was living. Uh-huh. In other words, me and whichever husband was there at the moment. And
but how? What? How was that anxiety communicated?
Well, she ended up really getting involved with alcohol and pills, uh-huh. and which she would take to calm her nerves, uh-huh. and that was painful for everyone, and so she struggled with that really throughout her life, and depression also, which, thank heaven, knock on wood, is something I did not inherit from her, although I did inherit her performance anxiety.
Oh, really?
And so it tended to generate cycles of alcohol abuse and misery and sadness, and so everyone around her was relieved when she finally made this decision.
So even you as a young child felt these felt these emotions and the depression and the
definitely
alcohol.
Yeah, definitely. So
did the alcohol change her behavior?
Yes. Yeah. But her fourth husband, my favorite, Bill Holman, when they got together and really fell in love with each other, they both stopped drinking together.
Wow.
And I thought that that was a real tribute to their feeling for one another and the seriousness of their relationship. And
Bill Holman is a wonderful musician.
He's a wonderful musician.
One of the main arrangers for Stan Kenton. He plays the saxophone.
Yeah, and he also has had his own band for 42 years. So it was just a relief when she made that decision. And so then after that, she started to teach piano, voice, and she especially took students who were interested in learning how to play the piano and sing at the same time, which was, of course, her specialty. So she had a much better time teaching, and the people who've studied with her have said that it was a real joy to study with her.
I never really considered my singing a style at all. I simply tried to sing the lyric intelligently and with the proper emotion in the proper places and pronounce the words right. And that's really all I did. I really wasn't at all stylized, I don't think. I hope.
No, I don't think so. But then again, even eliminating stylistic mannerisms, I think at the time at which you were starting your career, that must have been something a little unusual in the first place.
Oh, not really, because I hadn't really been interested in singing when I started to work. I started to work as a pianist in Omaha, Nebraska, in clubs and hotels around there. And then when I did start to sing, by that time I had listened to, as I was growing up, I heard Sinatra on the radio. And Nat Cole. Then I think many years after the fact, I realized that I had learned a lot about the reading of a lyric from my mother, who was what was then called an elocution teacher. She would be a drama coach today. But she used to have some of her students come to the house, and I always heard her talking about what to stress and what to accent and what to do and how to do it. And I never really listened, but I think through osmosis I learned something from her, because I was always very aware of diction and clarity and getting the sense of the thing across. I forgot what the question was. Did I answer it?
I think so. It kind of leads to another question, which is, okay, what are the ingredients for singing well, according to your recipe?
Oh, boy.
What pleases you when you hear a singer? What aspects of the performance might please you?
Well, I think just the things that I was referring to. A lot of singers emote too much, you know, or are too hung up on gimmicks. And there are a lot of things that I teach people to do, but they would include, had a dollar for every time I've said sing the vowel, not the consonant, I could retire now. it's hard to tell you without going into detail about the way I teach, but I feel that most singers sing all the vowels so that they sound alike, which makes the singing colorless. I feel that E and O should sound different. The timbre actually should be different. And ooh should sound different from I, and on. But I'm not going to give you a singing lesson for nothing, David. Let's face it.
Well, it's interesting because what you're saying now is evident in your own recordings. The vowel sounds are very special in your performances, I think.
They do have
a distinct and different set of sounds for each, come to think of it.
Thank you.
Can I forget you? Or will my heart remind me that once we walked in a moonlit dream?
When you performed in clubs, were you most often not playing the piano?
At one point, after I'd had kind of a semi-hit, the various people who were handling me, managers and agents and those people, thought that since I was young and not too ugly, that I should at one point stand up so that they could see what I looked like. Mm-hmm. So I did. I went into the whole thing with having my gowns made and all that stuff and carrying a pianist, which I needed like another nose. All that expense of traveling and everything. I already carried a bass player, and I almost always used the drummer who was in residence at Birdland or wherever I was. But I did carry a pianist for quite a few years, and I did one segment standing up, or one segment, I guess it was at the piano, whichever. But most of the time, if I worked in a smaller club or something, I just played for myself.
Is the image we have of you from your record covers, does that really reflect you? I mean, there you are on most of the covers in a strapless gown, looking very elegant.
Well, I like to wear sweats a lot. And I never was comfortable in those dresses. And I swore when I was finished with it that I would never wear another cincher in my life. And I haven't. In fact, I've hardly had a dress on. I really have only had one skirt on since 1964. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. So we might have seen you a little differently if we were seeing the real Jerry Southern on the record covers, I guess.
I think so.
What was your mother's childhood like? What do you know about it?
She was the youngest of six children. She was born in Royal, Nebraska, population 75 and going down. It's a lovely little teeny-weeny town. Her grandparents had come from Germany and opened a mill on a river. And her father, my grandfather, had lost the mill in the Depression, and that family was credited with starting the town of Royal, actually. And in the 100th anniversary of the town, my aunts, my mother's two sisters, were put up on the back of a convertible car and driven on the parade route down Main Street in Royal, which is three blocks long. And so, you know, it was small town America, and they did not have any money. My mother told me these heartbreaking stories of wanting to have a toy for Christmas, and her mother ended up giving her a pair of underwear for Christmas, and it made her cry. You know, it was terrible, terrible things like that. But somehow my grandparents managed to figure out how to enable her to go to Notre Dame Academy in Omaha for high school. This is something none of her siblings did.
Huh.
And because she had demonstrated a real musical talent growing up, played the piano, and actually was studying classical singing. I'm told that she got a scholarship to Juilliard for singing, operatic singing. But then she walked into a nightclub in Omaha and heard somebody playing jazz, and she just, it took her over, and she completely scuttled that idea and eventually moved to Chicago, like so many musicians did in the early and middle part of the 20th century, because Chicago was the happening place, you know.
I hadn't anyone till you. I was a lonely one till you.
I used to Jerry Southern isn't the name you were born with. I've heard tales of how Cary Grant, for the man who was Cary Grant, that name was a sort of a persona that he would put on.
Mm-hmm.
Is the name Jerry Southern anything like that for you? Or is it the real you?
I don't know what the real me is. My maiden name was Herring, and my first name is Genevieve, although I like Genevieve much better. But they called me Jenny when I was growing up, and I just hated it. So when I started to work, and I realized my name was going to be on a marquee, small though it was, I changed it to Jerry, just... I don't know why, don't ask me, but I thought at least started with the same kind of sound. And then I was using Jerry Herring, and I went to, on my way to Chicago, I stopped in Rockford, Illinois to work for a few weeks, and they had some music critic came in and saw me, and wrote something about my performance, and he referred to me as Cheery Herring, like the liqueur. And so I thought, well, it's time to do something about that. So I came up with Southern somehow. I don't know how, but I thought it was kind of mellifluous or something, harmonious. Anyway, it was better than the other one. So that's that story.
What made you finally actually stop recording and performing? And did you stop everything all at once? No more records, no more performing?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm.
I put my suitcases up on the shelf and put an ad in Variety and started to teach immediately. And, well, I stopped recording because at that time, that was kind of the beginning of the real heavy thrust of rock and roll in the early 60s. And... all of the singers were in trouble. There were many of us who didn't have contracts, Peggy Lee and I think Rosie Clooney and many, many singers were without a recording contract. I was one. And and then I'd stopped, so I really wasn't interested in doing it anymore. And
Did you slip from view, or was it news that you?
I crashed from view. I didn't even go into a nightclub for about 20 years. I just really quit everything all at once.
Did the public care?
No, they were heavily into rock at
yes.
that time.
They had turned to other things, I guess.
Yeah,
that's too bad.
Well. It's okay. I didn't want to do it anyway.
So I guess that short career of being the pop singer on the nightclub stage is really just one part of a continuing involvement with music that's
yes
began before that and has continued since.
Right. I started to teach actually when I was 16. I just when I got out of high school, and I taught for about 4 years. And it was during that time that I first heard jazz, and got into buying records and learning about it and playing.
You surprised me when we spoke prior to this interview by saying that you had to be sure to be practicing your classical piano works.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that you're still very involved in.
Sure. Well, it's like, keeping your body in shape. If you don't practice, the fingers go. And anyway, it's wonderful to play that beautiful music. I've been studying something almost all the time since I was 5 years old, and that wasn't last week. So I've been studying piano with Shirley Howard in Los Angeles for off and on for about 12 years. And I'm doing mostly Bach and Brahms, my faves.
And this is obviously to satisfy a personal interest. You're not going to go on the stage with this.
Oh, I hope not.
How would you describe your mother when you got to know her as an adult?
She had a terrific sense of humor. She was very bright. She, like my grandparents and like me because of her, was an avid crossword puzzle fanatic. She had a great thirst for knowledge and a spiritual element. She was raised a Catholic, as was I, but she didn't stay with Catholicism, but she had a deep curiosity about, I would say, the spiritual world. I found out to my surprise that she was fascinated by Gurdjieff. She was interested in numerology, which astonished me. I found that out kind of by accident when I came to visit her one time. And she was very well-informed about and enthusiastic about Carl Jung. She just was fascinated by his theories about why people do what they do and the things that shape behavior and the links to, archetypes. And she was fascinated by this, and she read extensively about it, so she knew a great deal about it. She went to a shrink her whole life. She came to feel that it was just part of living, like brushing your teeth. And she was a quiet, inward person. She hated parties. If there was more than one or two people in the room, she started feeling uncomfortable. So you can imagine what it took out of her to perform in nightclubs. She was friendly and kind and had a great streak of silliness, which I inherited for sure. And she, later in her life, she had a very close relationship with the film composer Hugo Friedhofer, who adored her. And they had he ended up moving into the same apartment building she lived in, and he lived on the same floor but down the hall. And they were thick as thieves till the end of his life. And so they had a relationship on a number of planes, on a deep musical level. Then he too was a very silly person, could be. And he used to make drawings for her. I still have a lot of his stuff that she left for me. So they were enjoying one another with humor always and with a deep musical knowledge, and they were very simpatico. I was about, I don't know, must have been 7 or 8 years old, living on Marmont Lane above Chateau Marmont in Hollywood. And I don't know why I remember this, but one day a gigantic bouquet of beautiful flowers showed up at the front door, and we couldn't imagine from whom it had come. And it turned out that it was from Hugo, and she didn't know Hugo at that time at all, but he was such an enormous fan of hers that he sent her these flowers. And it wasn't until decades later that they finally met one another, and until more years after that, that they ended up living in the same apartment building and having this very close friendship. So she was an intellectually curious person with a great sense of humor and, a kind, good person.
Hmm. And for listeners who don't know the name Hugo Friedhofer, one of the great, despite the name, American composers of music for film,
right.
The best years of our lives
he
is
the
his most
Award
famous.
For that, yes, yeah. I would go and visit them, and it was such a pleasure to speak with him because he had been there in the, you know, the 40s and 50s in Hollywood when Schoenberg was living there and Stravinsky was living there, and he was hanging out with all those guys. So it was really wonderful to talk with him, too, on a regular basis when I would go to visit her.
And Friedhofer orchestrated a number of film scores that he didn't compose. He worked in that field.
Casablanca, for example.
Really?
I think he did do that.
And your mom apparently did some orchestration for him on some of his work.
That's what I hear. I don't know to what degree that was the case, and I don't know what the projects were, but I did hear that. I think she told me that.
She speaks of it in
Does
the interview.
Uh-huh.
And I think I asked, you know, which scores? Oh, just some things.
Yeah. I'm not sure that whatever it was ever got released.
I
think he might have been working on something and she helped him or collaborated with him on it in some way.
Well, I was very close to Hugo for the last 9 years of his life. And before I met him, I had studied orchestration and film scoring with Albert Harris. So when Hugo was doing his writing in the last few years of his life, I did his orchestrating, and I did some of the cues for the films, and we did some songs together, and so we worked quite closely together. But first of all, I must say that orchestrating for Friedhofer was not a lot of decision making, you know, because he was very, very explicit about what he wanted, what instruments he wanted to do what with and when. And so it was kind of like being a glorified copyist, but one had to know, you know, be familiar with his writing so that one could tell whether it was a G or an A, because he tended to be careless when he was writing fast. So, you know, it took some skill, but he was the king of all the film composers. Most people agree. And it was a great privilege to work with him.
Have you written much instrumental music?
Yes, I've written a lot of piano music, and I've written some orchestral stuff, and not a whole lot. The first thing that I ever had performed was kind of a bad start, because I wrote a string quartet for a group at UCLA called the Twice Ensemble. I don't know why it was called that, but it was Paul Chihara's group. Paul Chihara is now doing some wonderful film scores. But at any rate, it was during the time I was studying, and I had given myself a kind of restriction in the time signatures. I started out with a 7-4 bar, and then I followed that with a 6-4 bar, and then a 5-4 bar, and on down to a 2-4 bar. And it was interesting, and it was challenging to do that and still make sense of it. But unfortunately, they didn't have much rehearsal time. So at the concert, at about the 3rd bar, they all got off. And for the rest of the whole piece, there was nobody in the same bar at the same time.
Oh.
And it really... Actually, it was quite surrealistic, but I've got to get that out and play it sometime. But I haven't really tried very hard to get performances on things. I did have some songs recorded quite a few years ago. Tony Bennett and Peggy Lee and a couple of other people recorded some things. But then I got into teaching, and I kind of didn't do too much writing for a long time. But I'm getting into it again. I've submitted a lot of stuff to publishers in the past, and have gotten lots of rejection slips. And they always say wonderful things like, we love your, or we like very much your music, and it's well written, and it's this, and it's that. But at this time, we're not doing that sort of thing. So try later or something. So they go up on the shelf. Mm. And but I think maybe now's the time. I don't know.
Does it discourage you when you get the rejection?
Oh, no, because really, you know, after I've written something, the fun is over.
So you've had your fun with it.
Yeah, know? Right. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly, it would be nice to hear it performed, but I'm usually onto something else quickly.
And you don't want to sing again?
No, I do not. Is that enough?
I think so.
The songs that I write, I think you'll agree, are somewhat esoteric, and I really can't see Madonna or Duran Duran or the Stones or somebody doing these things. So I'm going to try to get some of the long hairs to do it. I also teach piano and do a lot with piano accompanying. I'm so finicky about my compositions that I will hardly ever let any other pianist near them until I get the complete thing notated so that there won't be one wrong note. Mm-hmm. Really, it's kind of silly, I guess. But also, I like to play, so why not?
Mm-hmm. That makes me think of some of your early recordings where you take little piano solos in the course of a piece. Were those composed by you, or were those improvisations?
They were all improvisation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I appreciate the fact that you you weren't always doing the expected thing. You were not necessarily experimenting, but trying something new with your solos.
Yeah. Well, I really had a lot of nerve in those days, and I guess I still do if you talk to any of my students. But I tend to be bossy. For one thing, I'm a Leo, and that kind of has something to do with it, I think. But in those days, for instance, when I recorded When I Fall in Love, that was a Victor Young song, and that was only my second single record. And Victor Young and Eddie Heyman, who wrote the lyric, came into the studio at Decca. I had an appointment with them to hear the song, and they performed it for me. Victor played, and Eddie Heyman sang, and I just loved it immediately. And a few days later, I guess it was, Victor kind of outlined the arrangement for me and told me how many bars intro there was going to be and various things. And he said there was going to be a piano passage in the intro. And so I told my producer that I wanted to play that, and he was horrified because, you know, Victor Young only used the best studio musicians in New York. And he said, I can't possibly tell Victor that you want to play. And I said, well, I really want to. And, you know, I can do it. Just get me the score and I'll learn it. I guess it was the day before the session or something. And so I think that I kind of, unnerved a few people, possibly even Victor Young. But I did it all right, I think. You know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I could have, you know, it could have been a little more legato, but I can't go do it again.
Were you the first to record that song?
Yes, I was. Although mm-hmm. they, they give Nat Cole the credit for it. He recorded it about 10 years later. But I had well, it was really a hit. It wasn't a major hit. Like, if I knew you were coming, I'd have baked a cake. But, which was at that time, by the way. But it did very, very well for me. And Doris Day also had a record of it. And she had enough hits. So, you know, hers didn't do quite so well, but that's all right. I'm sure that she didn't worry about that. I really had the record that made the noise in those days. And then I guess recently it's kind of come back. I'm hearing it a lot. Not my version, but a lot of new people are doing it. So I'll take the credit for that, okay, along with Mr. Young and Mr. Heyman.
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love. As
your mom got older and she was not drinking to cope with depression, how did she cope with depression, or was she not feeling that at that time?
Well, she, luckily in her later years, she was seeing a shrink all the time, which helped. She did take a lot of pills. And
Even later.
And I think that that's one of the things that contributed to her death, because she went to the hospital with double pneumonia, and her friend Ruth Cameron went with her with all the prescriptions, which is what you're supposed to do when you go to the emergency room. You're supposed to tell them about all the drugs you're taking. And half of these bottles said, do not stop taking suddenly. And they took her off all these pills. And I think that was stressful for her heart. She ended up having a heart attack the day before her 65th birthday. That's as long as she lived.
Wow, really? She was that young?
Yeah. And I was very surprised and disappointed, because I was really counting on her to be there for... I had my children very late, and so I was hoping that she could be there as their grandma, because I have such fond memories of her mother and of being... you know, having a wonderful grandma. And she was a terrific grandma to my children, but they hardly saw one another because we lived 3,000 miles away from one another. But I would say that she exercised more in later years, because this apartment she lived in had a pool and she loved swimming. And so I think that it was a matter of her intellectual pursuits to some. I think that these theories of Gurdjieff and Jung and kind of immersing herself in these things constantly, along with the therapy and the exercise and the pills, all of those things kept her on an even keel in her later years. It feels funny to say later years, because, you know, at this point, almost 65 seems so young.
She says in the interview that she's been studying one thing or other since she was about 5 years old. Mm-hmm. What would that have been? Music?
Probably piano. Yes. I'm pretty sure she was not studying voice in Royal, because she left to go to high school, so she would have been, you know, quite young when she left home. She studied guitar with a very sexy Italian guitar teacher named Joe Ceracci, whose recipe for red sauce I still make. and what else did she... It was mostly guitar and piano, even throughout her whole life. After she stopped singing, she played her whole life. She used to play Beethoven sonatas and Debussy, and there are two Brahms intermezzi that I just love. And I told her about this at some point in a conversation. By that time, I was living in New York. And I came back to see her several months later, and she's learned my favorite one and played it for me. It was so lovely, so sweet. So she really loved playing the piano, and she loved improvising at the piano. And as I mentioned on the liner notes for the compilation I did of her work in 1998, when she didn't think anyone was listening, she would really just sit and explore at the keyboard. And it was the most wonderful journey she took on the piano. You never knew where it was going. Oftentimes, harmonically, it sounded like she was about to jump off a cliff. And then she would come back in the most subtle but completely logical ways, harmonically. She had a very deep, thorough command of harmony, which allowed her to do this. But she wasn't thinking at all of what she was doing. She just sat there and played. And I loved hearing her doing that. And I had to be careful to keep quiet, because otherwise she probably would have stopped.
Ah. Well, Catherine was able to supply me with an old cassette with your mother's handwriting on it. And it turns out it contains a gorgeous piano improvisation.
I'm delighted about that.
And it's lovely, thoughtful. It's that nice quality that an improvisation can have. Someone is just sitting there following their muse,
dreaming,
trying things out, dreaming. Exactly.
Thank you.
Jerry Southern, improvising at the piano, or dreaming, as her daughter Catherine described it. I discovered that recording just a couple weeks ago when Catherine loaned me a cassette that had been her mother's. And on the cassette, all it says in Jerry's handwriting is work. And it's mostly some of Jerry's vocal students, performances recorded during their lessons. And then that gorgeous piece and fantastic opportunity to hear Jerry thinking and dreaming at the piano. My thanks to Catherine for her insights in our conversation and for her permission to use that recording. And thanks to the engineer at radio station KCRW, who recorded Jerry Southern's end of my conversation with her in 1990, and to WNYC Radio for the use of that interview from the Spinning on Air archive. This podcast with Jerry Southern is the third in a sort of triptych of programs that feature singers. The first was Diane Cluck, the second Julius Eastman, and now Jerry Southern. And you can learn more and hear a lot more on the website for this podcast, spinningonair.org. And on the page for this episode, you'll find embedded a Spotify playlist I made of some of my favorite Jerry Southern recordings. So that provides a lot more to listen to from her. Please rate and review Spinning on Air on iTunes or on your podcasting app. Spread the word however you can. Tell your friends. Share on social media. You can even support the podcast directly via PayPal and Patreon. Find links and info at spinningonair.org. I'm David Garland. I produce the podcast independently. Spinning on Air is a registered trademark of WNYC Radio, used by permission.
I've been speaking with Jerry Southern here on Spinning on Air, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, David. It's really been a pleasure. I haven't done one of these for a long time, and you were very good at what you do, and I thank you for making me comfortable.
Great.
That was a nice interview, David.
Good.